Mammoth!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's episode, my books and live shows, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? If you don't, then I'll be forced to cram this podcast full of pledge drives and sycophantic plugs for Squarespace. And nobody wants that. We've all had a magician mess with our heads and experienced that jaw-dropping moment when our senses fail us and reality flies out the window. But neither magicians nor their audiences rarely stop to ask exactly how they're messing with our heads. What is going on deep in our grey matter that makes us fall for the simplest of tricks and miss what's happening right under our noses? On this episode, I speak with neuroscientists Stephen L. Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde, authors of the books Sleights of Mind, What the Neuroscience of Magic Reveals About Everyday Deception, and founders of the scientific discipline Neuromagic. The hand is quicker than the eye, but these two are even quicker. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. How do you define neuromagic? What is neuromagic?
Neuromagic is a term that we coined to refer to the relationship and that collaboration between these two fields that are of magic and neuroscience, which you may think at first sight have very little in common, but in fact, there are great areas of overlap between them.
Magic and neuroscience both relate to how we attend and are aware of things in the world around us.
Does that mean then that magic has been ruined for you too now, that you can't watch a magic show and enjoy it because you're constantly, not only are you figuring out the secrets more and more, but also you are constantly trying to figure out what's going on in your own brains?
The fact of the matter is that we've gotten much more interested in it. So the first time we had an interaction with magicians, when James Randi had already put together this dinner with some of the world's major magicians and us in order to discuss the project. And so, we started at the very top from the very beginning.
So do you see yourselves as magicians or do you see yourselves as lay people?
Oh, as a lay person, yes. I guess we are something in between. We like to think of ourselves as retired magicians. We actually took magic lessons for a year so that we could audition for membership as magician members of the Academy of Magical Arts, the Magic Castle in Hollywood. And we did pass the admittance test, and then we performed in front of a jury of magicians. And we were just barely good enough, but we made it in based on our magic performance. So we are technically magicians, and frankly we haven't been able to keep up with the practice. Even when we started learning about magic, and a number of magicians brought this up to us, that typically a member, a layperson, will become interested in magic often at the age of 8 or 9, and when you get your first magic set, and you start practicing, and you first learn to do a few simple sleights, and then a few more complicated ones. And it's only later on, perhaps after a number of years, that you figure out how to handle attention. And then you get more involved with that. But that only comes, that understanding of perception and attention is only secondary to learning some manipulations and being pretty good with your hands by then. In our case, we were coming into magic from a lateral perspective because we were knowledgeable about perception and attention from our research. So we could understand a lot of the manipulations and a lot of the sleight of hand that magicians use without being able to perform it ourselves necessarily.
So you were a little bit like an airplane engineer. You know exactly how an airplane works and how to build one, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to fly one yourselves.
I like that metaphor a lot. And in fact, even among magicians, there are magicians that are very good at developing tricks that other magicians perform, but they themselves are not strong performers because they're not very charismatic or they lack some other skills or simply they're not interested. So they don't perform. They only design and invent tricks for the magicians to use.
I would say I like the pilot before as well. we could expertly understand why we were crashing the plane.
You mentioned, Susanna, you mentioned attention and perception. From my perspective, having performed magic, I do feel like tension, being able to manipulate an audience's attention and their perception, really is the key to magic. From a neuroscience point of view, what are the mechanics that are going on inside the brain when a magician is say misdirecting an audience member or drawing their attention away from a method? What's actually going on a neurological level in our brains?
So when you pay attention to something, what you're really doing is suppressing everything else. While you're paying attention to my left hand, you're suppressing my right hand. So if I tell you to pay attention to this finger, it gives me the ability to do something over here. I'm using your own attentional system to suppress the things that you don't understand or rather aren't paying attention to. And one of the things that we've learned in our work with neuroscience, in our research with our colleagues at SUNY and at the University of Connecticut, is that in space, in the brain has a map of space, and in that space, when you pay attention to a given point in space, you're not really enhancing that point in space, which was one theory of how attention worked. What actually is happening is you're suppressing everything else. So you're reducing the amount of noise of information that's unwanted from areas of your visual field that are unwanted. And that, by virtue of suppressing all of that stuff you don't want, that noise, you increase the signal of what you do want. And so that's really what attention is, in terms of the neural mechanisms. And that's what magicians in many ways have been doing with misdirection, is they've been tricking the audience to pay attention to one thing, the wrong thing, while they pull a stunt in the other part of the visual field or with another feature at the same part of the visual field so that the spectator doesn't notice it.
And this sort of filtering out of information, is that neural adaptation?
Yeah, that's something that that has evolved presumably to allow us to be more focused and to concentrate on something complicated for long periods of time. Just imagine none of the works of art or we enjoy today would have been possible if people hadn't been able to pay attention to very complicated problems for long periods of time. But these same adaptation also provides a loophole for magicians to use to their advantage in their shows.
Yeah, one of the forms of this filtering out or removing information is change blindness. And that, as I understand, that's the idea that if we can be unaware of fairly obvious changes that are actually happening right in front of our eyes. I can understand how we might ignore the existence of something. So you might ignore the magician putting his hand into his pocket to get out a secret coin or so on. But the idea that something can be changing right in front of your eyes while you're actually picking up that stimuli and not be aware of it, to me, seems incredible. And yet I've been fooled by all of those change blindness videos that you can see on YouTube. How does change blindness actually work in our brain?
It is not the eyes that see, it is the brain. And that's why you can say, close your eyes and imagine the face of a person you know, and you can see that person in front of you even in the absence of visual input. So that already tells you that the brain is extremely important to our sense of vision. And so when we are looking at something, it also is the case that if we are not paying attention, that we're not going to see that. And that's why we can be daydreaming. And that means that we're paying attention to our internal world, and somebody can be in front of us even saying our name, and they may have to yell at us for us to wake up even though our eyes are open. But we're seeing all of this inner world and nothing of the information that is in front of us. Now, the magicians don't get us to daydream, but they're very effective at manipulating our attention. So we may be looking at something, but the magician has allocated our attention somewhere else, or the magician has divided our attention in many different simultaneous places, so we cannot be fully focused on any one of them.
Something that I see sort of coming up again and again in neuroscience, but particularly when people talk about neuromagic, is the concept of saccades.
So saccades are eye movements that you make from one point to another. Let me just hold up my hands here again. You can see my eyes looking at my left finger, and then I look at my right, and then I look at my left. And you can see my eyes are jumping back and forth as I do that. Now, if I try and hold out your fingers and do the same thing, if you try and move your eyes smoothly between them, you can't. You make little jumps instead, so you're making little saccades. But now, if you look at your right finger and move it to your left finger and back, while looking at your right finger, you can see your eye is tracking smoothly. So that's called pursued eye movements, and your pursuit system can move your eyes smoothly if you're tracking something, but not if you're not tracking. If you're not actually tracking a moving thing, you can only make saccades. And while you're making saccades, while your eye's actually in flight, so that the world doesn't look like a big earthquake, your visual system actually suppresses all that information, all the smear across your visual field as your eyes move. So you're literally blind during a saccade, during the flight of a saccade. You can't see. And so this is called saccadic saccades are one way that you move your eyes in jumps, and you're blind during them. And so this is actually very important to the way that certain magic sleights are accomplished, even though magicians didn't even realize that this was happening, that there were these two different behaviors. They just realized if they moved their hands in certain ways that subjects would fall for certain types of magical murder. When we started working with these people, we realized that it must be due to the eye movement.
If I was to get a coin in my left hand and throw it into my right hand, but actually keep it hidden in my left hand, there's that moment where the person's eyes jump automatically from the left hand to the right hand. Are you saying sort of in that moment where the eyes are kind of leaping from one target to the other, that they're blind, so they can't see that the coin isn't traveling?
The magic effect is really that you see the coin flying, even though it never actually left.
Yeah.
Someone feels like they see the coin when in fact they don't. And we studied this with Mac King and published a paper on that specific trick. Because Mac King happens to be, by many people's opinion, one of the finest magicians to perform a coin toss. Now, having said that, there are tricks where the magician manipulates your eye movements with either saccades or pursued eye movements to get specific effects. So, for example, when Apollo Robbins steals from a pocket, he might move his hand in a curved shape so that the person will follow his hand with pursued eye movement, and that attentional focus will go with it, with the hand. But if he moves his hand in a straight line, the person makes saccades, and then the last place they paid attention to after they've made their saccade is back at the pocket. So often they'll look back at the pocket. So he'll use these two effects to different ends. For example, if he wants to move his hand away from someone's pocket when he's not stealing something, and they look at his hand and then look back at the pocket and see that their glasses are still there, or their pen, or their money, then he can get them used to the idea that he's touching their pockets and not stealing something. And then when he's ready to actually make a steal, he'll move his hand in a curved shape, and then they follow with pursued eye movements, and then the last place they actually paid attention is actually right at the end of the arc of the movement, and they don't go all the way back to the pocket, so they don't notice that it's gone for a long time.
So a lot of that is to do with the idea that brain is also trying to predict what his hand is going to do next. It seems like he does one action over and over, you know, repeatedly, and then when he does the magic, the brain seems to just assume that he's doing exactly the same thing that he did previously.
Well, I think it's more about that he wants you to track his hand, and the person wants to track his hand because this is a show, right? They know he's a pickpocket and that he's going to steal stuff from them. So they want to see him do it. They want to catch him in the act. So what the obvious thing to do is track his hands. But if he knows that, he can move his hands in such a way that that is what enables him to then steal from your pockets with his other hand or at a different time, because you actually fall for it and use your attention in the wrong way. He's misdirected you. He's led you down the garden path of attentional misdirection by using his hands in such a way that you're looking at the wrong place at the wrong time or paying attention to the wrong place at the right time.
Susanna, you study saccades as they're related also to neurological disorders.
Yeah, so we have done a number of studies relating saccades and other eye movements to neurological disease. We have been looking at Parkinson's disease and other Parkinsonian disorders Alzheimer's disease, mild cognitive impairment. The rationale is that your oculomotor system, the system in your brain that controls and targets your eye movements, is spread. Basically, it engages areas all over your brain. The frontal lobes are implicated. Your cerebellum is implicated, brainstem, midbrain. So that means that if you have a neurological disease of whatever kind, it would be basically impossible to have damage to a brain area and not have that reflected in the pattern and in the eye, in the dynamics of the eye movements that you produce. So eye movements can be very helpful to diagnose, to help diagnose neurological disease and even to evaluate the efficacy of the treatments of the patients.
So that means that a neurologist could technically look at someone's eyes or maybe track, you put them in some sort of eye tracking software and be able to get a sense of exactly what's happening inside their brain based on how they're looking and where their eyes are moving?
Well, it would be not necessarily the only part or the only part, it shouldn't be the only part of the diagnosis, but it could be a critical part of the diagnosis. It wouldn't be solely by looking at the eyes, but it would probably involve measuring these eye movements with a sensitive device because some of the anomalies are not going to be apparent to the naked eye. And that and the advantage of using eye movement measures to try and identify neurological disease is that, in the first place, it's a non-invasive test that is comfortable for the patient, and also it's something that anybody could basically be able to apply. Potentially even patients might be able to, or people in general might be able to get an idea of whether their eye movements are abnormal or not just by looking at them themselves if you have an app on your iPhone, say.
I hear a lot of mentalists and magicians as well talk a lot about eye movements as a part of their patter. So you might get someone up doing a lie detector routine where they're trying to spot who's lying and who's telling the truth. And they'll point out that, this person's looking up and to the left or down and to the right, and therefore they're lying or telling the truth, which is obviously a myth, as I understand. It's just not true.
There is no way to know with certainty if anybody is lying or not. There is no scientific method to assess that with any kind of certainty right now.
Does it frustrate you when you see magicians using neurological or psychological terms as part of their patter? So you get a lot of magicians who claim that they're reading body language or that there's a neurological study that said something or you know, neuro-linguistic programming, which I'm sure is something that must be the bane of your existence. Is that something that frustrates you as scientists when you see magicians using neurological or psychological terms incorrectly as part of their patter?
Yes, absolutely. So we've only worked with, or only continue to work with magicians who agree that it's better to not try and feed baloney to their audience than it is to try and trick them into thinking they have powers or that they're using some sort of scientific method that is false. It's unnecessary to achieve the magical feeling in the audience to lie to them in that way. And as really, you know, people like Houdini and James Randi and Penn and Teller have really made very clear that magic is perfectly fun and acceptable, and it doesn't deepen the effects at all for you to buy into the idea that your magician happens to be to have superpowers. And so it's unnecessary, and we don't work with we haven't worked with mentalists or any other magicians who make those types of claims.
And I agree with Steve, and I think that what's important to emphasize is that it is not, I mean, it doesn't personally bother me, it's just the opposite. If a magician uses a neuroscientific term or they use it well. If a magician wants to refer to the brain or to eye movement, I don't have any problems with that. The problem is when they refer to pseudoscience.
It seems like neuroscience and psychology in magic has really taken over a lot from what was previously presented as spiritualism or supernatural abilities. So maybe 50, 100 years ago, people would claim that they were talking to dead people or they had these sort of superhuman powers, whereas now magicians like to claim that they have super neuroscientific powers, I guess you would call them, that just go a step further.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental thing to do is to always be accurate. Okay, so being precise isn't necessary, and obviously, just as I can't perform a magic trick as well as virtually any professional, any professional magician, it's unlikely that they can describe the neuroscience as precisely as a neuroscientist can. What's important is that they're always accurate. Okay, so I think that that as long as magicians are accurate with the science they're portraying, they don't have to be precise. They can just say, you know, attention is a brain mechanism, and its effect is to suppress things that you're not paying attention to. Whereas when you pay attention to something, you're not really enhancing it, but you're just suppressing everything else. That would be an accurate statement, and that's perfectly fine. But to make a claim that he can actually see your microsaccades and determine what it is your inner thoughts are by viewing those, in the same way that Susanna's lab has studied microsaccades using high technology, that actually misleads people.
One of the things that you must come across a lot is that you, as scientists, your goal is to discover the truth and then to communicate and educate people about what you have discovered using the scientific method. And yet the role of magic is ultimately to keep the truth hidden and to not tell people exactly what is going on and to keep those secrets. Throughout your book, you've been great in that you have spoiler alerts all the way through and a little pointy finger to tell people if you don't want to know the secret, now's the time to bail out, which I think is brilliant. Do the two of you have a code that you operate by in terms of the exposure of secrets and magic?
Well, magic and as an art, magic is an art, and neuroscience is a field of science. So their goals are different, but they're not incompatible. The goal of magic is to entertain, and part of the entertainment is that you don't give away all the information. That doesn't mean that you should provide wrong information. That wouldn't be ethical. But you don't need to give it all away. And in our particular situation, as neuroscientists and science educators, we want to talk to the public about neuroscience. But when we're talking about the neuroscience of magic, sometimes that means that we need to expose some magic, and we do expose as little magic as we can, and we do it by a code that we belong to the main magician organizations, the Magic Castle, the Magic Circle in England, the International Brotherhood of Magicians, Society of American Magicians, and most of these societies will require or will ask that you do not expose magic. But there are some allowances. For instance, you can write a magic book in which you teach tricks to people who want to become magicians and so on. The main thing is that you do not expose a secret method to somebody who doesn't want to know. And say if somebody is in the bookstore just browsing the shelves and they pick up our book and just by chance they find a secret method, that person may not be happy that because they prefer not to know. So that's why we have the spoiler alert, so that you don't land on a page that you wish you hadn't.
Recently, I was doing a show, and the person who booked me requested a specific routine that they'd seen me do 2 years earlier, and it was the bill in lemon, which I'm sure you're aware of, is a $50 note disappears and reappears in a lemon. And the person requested the routine, and then I came and I performed and everyone enjoyed the show, and she came out afterwards and said, oh, that was great, but I wish you'd done the routine you did last time. And she described what had happened was that she had written her name on $50, put it in her wallet. The $50 had vanished from her wallet and appeared in a lemon that was that was sitting on the kitchen table of someone's house. It was their own lemon, and that then they had picked it up and they had cut it open. They'd taken out the $50 and it was there, which is not the trick that I'd done at all. But that's what she'd remembered, that she'd remembered this miracle. And so it was kind of awkward because I didn't want to say, well, you're wrong, because that's not what I did, because the legend of what I'd done was far better than what I could really do. Yeah, ta-da, thank you, good night. What role do you think memory and how people remember magic plays in the whole magic experience?
Well, one important component, memory is very important for magic, obviously, for a magician. It's not only important that people can't dissect the trick the magician is on stage, but it's also in the magician's best interest that people go home and that they're not able to remember exactly what took place, because then they're not going to be able to figure it out later either, so that we feel more magical. And then memory is fallible, so chances are that as time passes, you're going to remember less and less well, and then develop a much more spectacular memory of what happened. And part of it is the fact that we cannot remember very well things that we don't pay attention to. And since the magician is so good at misdirecting our attention, then the chances that our memory is going to be intact are very little. And that's probably a great part of what happened with the famous Indian rope trick, which was a hoax. It started as a hoax. There were a lot of eyewitness reports over many years describing this spectacular trick in which it was supposedly conducted in India, and a magician would in the middle of an area free of trees or houses or anything, he would throw a rope into the air and the rope would stay up, and a little child, a boy, the magician's assistant, would climb up and disappear into the clouds. The magician would ask him to come down. The child would refuse. The magician would climb up after him, disappear into the clouds, start yelling at the child, and then pieces of the child would fall from the clouds, a foot, a leg, all the child would fall in pieces. And then the magician would come down and feel very sorry that he had done that, and he regretted so much, and he would put the child in a basket and do some spell, and the child would come out whole again. Obviously, that has never happened in such a way, and yet there are many dozens of people have reported that they saw it with their own eyes.
And is that because whatever they did see, they had an emotional reaction to it, and then they needed to, I guess, create a memory that sort of lived up to the emotional experience?
Well, it could be that.
It's hard to tell what happened. I mean, we can only speculate long after the fact. Mm. In all likelihood, different people experienced different parts of this particular illusion, but they couldn't have experienced the whole illusion. And that then decades after, it's just hard to know. And emotions might have played a role as well. And this is exactly why, one reason why eyewitness reports are so unreliable, because if somebody is providing their testimony about what happened during a crime, they were likely very emotionally affected, and their memory is not going to be neutral at all, so it's going to be distorted.
And, you know, I think that one of the things here is that magicians use memory manipulation as well in order to hide what they're doing so it can't be figured out after the fact. So, for example, if a magician does a card trick, and then they say, well, let's recap, right? Whenever that happens, a red flag should go up, because what happens is they often can then recap it wrong, right? So they recap it slightly wrong. So it's just a little bit off. It's not something you might catch when they're saying it. So they may say, okay, you had a deck of cards. You picked a card of your own volition, or you thought of a card, or you came up with a card, when in fact they handed you a card, or they used the deck in such a way that the card was given to you. And so what they've done here is they've taken one of your long-term memories and you've taken it out of long-term memory to while you're thinking about it, and they've injected wrong information into that memory while they're saying it back to you. And then you save that long-term memory again, now with the wrong information. So your actual memory has now been updated, and it's incorrect. So when you remember it again tomorrow or a year from now, you actually remember the wrong story, and that this recapping method is actually a really good way to update and change someone's memories to be wrong. And there's very good neuroscience evidence that this is, in fact, something that can happen with long-term memories, and that when you remember long-term memories, they come out of long-term memory. They're destroyed from your long-term memory while you work with them in your short-term working memory. And then when you put them back into long-term memory, they're put back with any of the noise that may have occurred while you were thinking about it. Again, this was a case where magicians were using techniques that just so happened to work because it reflected really interesting neuroscientific principles about how memory happens, memory formation and memory storage happen. And it just took a long time for neuroscientists to figure it out exactly what was happening on their own.
It's almost as if your brain is sort of it's like an IKEA piece of furniture, and every time you kind of pull it apart and put it back together again, you're almost redrawing the plans and making a new set of plans. So then the next time you build it, you're starting with a different set of instructions on how to put this table together.
Yeah, every single time, a few more extra parts, you know.
That's why IKEA gives us extra parts whenever we buy something to remind us of the fragility of human memory.
That are still on the floor in your desk.
A lot of what you guys have mentioned so far has related to sight, so what we see and how we perceive things visually. But obviously, we have other senses as well, and I assume, and our brain obviously processes those in different ways. I sent you a video a few days ago. I'm not sure if you had a chance to have a look at it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll put a link on the video so the listeners can see it. It'll be at conman.com.au. Essentially, the routine is a member of the audience is brought up, they close their eyes, and they link their fingers together, or they hold the magician's arms sort of tightly so that it forms a sort of a ring of flesh. And then the magician gets a solid metal ring, and while their eyes are closed, melts the ring through their arm. Now, the entire audience can see exactly what he's doing, and they can see exactly how that ring gets onto his arm. Because their eyes are closed, they have this entirely different experience, they have this miracle of the ring linking on impossibly. Is there a neurological phenomena that's going on where when you're one of your senses, so when you remove sight, in this example, your other senses are acting in a different way to try and compensate? Is there something neurological going on here?
Not necessarily. It may be that in people who have lacked one of the senses for a very long time, they have developed adaptations over time and strategies that allow them to function differently from people that have all their senses intact. In this particular magic trick, that is not happening. This is a person that has perfect sight. He's simply closing his eyes for a moment, and obviously he doesn't have access to visual information. So what he's doing is that he is directing his attention to non-visual information, as he must. And what this illusion reveals is that the same limitations and the same shortcuts that we use with our vision apply to the other senses as well, because the volunteer, the spectator from the audience, he is given incomplete information and ambiguous information, but his brain is closing in the gaps, quite literally, like the gaps in the hangar, so that he perceives that he's getting a complete object or a complete stimulus when that is not the case. And the other thing that is happening is that, but he is receiving all of this auditory information from the magician's patter, and the magician is telling him what those touches mean. So he is already biasing his tactile perception by giving him the meaning without letting him make his own arrive to his own conclusion.
You mentioned blind people. As I understand it, in blind people, they've found that over time their visual cortex starts to pick up information from touch.
It's hard to know what kind of visualization, if any, blind people or, say, people who are blind from birth might have. But we also know that there is a lot of attentional feedback to the visual cortex. So it might be that this type of apparent visual activation that occurs in the visual cortex of blind people when they perform tasks by sound and touch might be a matter of their attention is allocated to those stimuli instead, and it's not a real visual experience.
Thank you so much for being on Scammapalooza today.
It was unnecessary.
Thank you so much for having us.
If people would like to find out more about your work, they can go to sleightofmind.com. And just to recap, you found me to be charming and intelligent, and you enjoyed yourself a great deal.
It was a real pleasure.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.